This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Our guest is Paul Likert. Paul is a case manager with the Chattanooga Housing Authority, where he works with the homeless in Chattanooga. He's also an adjunct professor teaching creative writing at Covenant College on Lookout Mountain, and he is a published author. His most recent collection is called Metropolia. We began our conversation with Paul reading a poem from the collection of poems and short stories published in June of this year.
This is from my chapbook. It's called Metropolia. It's a chapbook about sort of city life. I have a companion chapbook called Bucolia, which is about country life that hasn't come out yet. But this one, it draws inspiration from Chicago, where I used to live, and New Orleans, which I visited once, and I was only there for a week, and I couldn't put down my pen. I had this the whole time I was writing nonstop. So I'll read the first. So this is a collection of some poetry and some short fiction. And I'll read this first poem, which is sort of my first impressions of the city of New Orleans, being somebody who had never been there before. The poem is called Bang. Wild city, swinging, banging town, all buzzing colors, gonzo tweets and hyperventilations. The air in the streets is pig slop, fruit punch, hurry up hurricanes, vomit in a fishbowl. Hey, boy, oh, what a beatific bang. What a swing time town. What a god holy place. The clodhopper stomps of the pop along bands. Wow, wee, what a sound. Spin me, Mother Mary, in holy hip reverie. Crash me into heaven with the saints. So that's Bang.
Life. That was my impression of New Orleans. It never stops, and there's always something going on.
I loved it.
We sat in this restaurant watching these boys across the street doing some kind of shuffle.
Yeah.
Right? And all of a sudden, they stop, dash off into some doorway, and the cruiser comes by.
Yeah.
The cruiser goes by, right back out there doing it again.
Absolutely. I loved it. When I was there, it was about as far away from Mardi Gras in the course of the year as you could possibly be. And it was still a banging, swinging, wild town. 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, like a band that's going by on the street. And it wasn't just on Bourbon Street. I mean, it seemed to be like everywhere in the downtown area. And I loved it. I thought this, I almost didn't come back. I almost said I live in New Orleans now. After like 1 week, calling my wife and say, you can come down here and like it if you would join me, but I'm living in New Orleans now.
I don't know. You know, it's the classic example of that cliche, you know, nice place to visit, but, you know, I can't imagine what it'd be like to live there, you know?
I wonder what that would be like. There was a real sense that, you know, I think there's that saying that Vegas kind of made up about itself, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Mm. But I think with New Orleans, there's a real sense of equality in that you could be a businessman from New York down for a conference. You could be a cowboy from the West in town for sort of drifted into town. You could be like me. I was there for a conference for work. And you're all treated equally. Everybody's the same. Everybody gets the same chance at a good time, at sort of getting your mind blown in any number of ways. So there was a real sense that everybody has a chance to experience New Orleans on equal footing, no matter who you are. And it seemed like, from my observation, everybody was taking advantage of that to the hilt.
Yeah, it's very much a giving culture, but at the same time, I guess partly my views of New Orleans have been shaped by that show Treme.
I have not watched it yet.
That's definitely told from the point of view of an insider.
Yes.
And actually the abiding impression I have from that show is that and that's not news to anybody, life is hard for black people. And it isn't any different in New Orleans than anywhere else. They're struggling, and yet they are the ones who are ultimately making the place what it is and giving of everything they have.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for me, when I find something, a place or a person or whatever interesting, I end up, you know, immediately going on a rabbit trail. So reading what I can read about it, all this kind of stuff. And I, you know, being somebody who was not from New Orleans and was experiencing it for the first time, I'm reading about this stuff. And we're talking, I mean, this is going back to not just before France, but like Spain. So it's like Spain, France, United States. Mm-hmm. And the history of the African-American experience through sort of these three, what we would normally think of as white civilizations, so the States, Spain, and France, all of them subjugating the African-American experience in whatever way seemed best to them, slavery, of course, being the number one thing, but it seemed like there were many other ways. But the richness of all of those African American and African cultures, Caribbean cultures coming together, I got the sense that it was almost as alive as it was when I was there as it was maybe when it first came in the 1700s or was forced to come in the 1700s. That sense of history was really present, like you were saying about sort of the building of the culture of the city, that still seemed to be, you know, hurricanes and racism and slavery and Napoleon selling it to the States. Through all of that, those cultural building blocks, at least to an outsider like me, still seemed to be the vibrancy of the city. And I thought that was amazing. And it's hard to for me to think of another place where I felt quite like that.
I know, that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, I haven't really thought about that, but, you know, one of the first things that the slave owners did was outlaw drums.
Yeah.
Because that was a way for people to communicate, you know, or at least they thought it was anyway. And yet, you know, that's such a classically clueless move because it's not the drum. That's right. That's inside every person that they were trying to subjugate.
Oh, yeah.
And you may take away the instrument, but you're not going to take away what drives them, that musicality.
Absolutely.
That is at the heart of New Orleans culture, you know?
Absolutely. I think if I could just pick one adjective to describe the city, it would be rhythmic.
Mm.
Because, you know, you could look out your hotel room window and see sort of the rhythm of the changing of the traffic lights in time to the band that's going along the street, in time to the footfalls of the tourists on the sidewalk, all of it sort of meshing together. I think it just seems to be in the bones of the city.
I think so too. That's how it struck me. It's like it's part of the fabric of the place. We're walking down what appeared to be a residential side street.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden there's what appears to be a private home, there's a whole club going and band playing and all kinds of people spilling out of the place and having a grand time.
It's such a, it reminds me, I felt very, you know, kind of Kerouacian because it was just like, well, let me look in every doorway. Let me see what's going on over here. There's music coming out over there. Let me go in there. Let me taste the food over here. What are you guys drinking right here? Let me get a drink of, I don't know what it is, but let me get a drink of that. Whatever. Let me sit and listen to this band.
We'll be right back.
Let me see where the locals are. Let me go down to the golf. Everything. It was just a sort of a nonstop sense of exploration. It felt
so. Is the writer's life an experiential life for you? Are you, to some degree, looking for experience so you have material?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, we had, I think in world culture there were various different ages of exploration. So the sort of the conquistadors, and then your Shackletons and these guys who were picking out early 20th century, sort of picking out the last unexplored places. So we got the Arctic and the Antarctic. And so, you know, unless you're looking to explore the bottom of the sea, which I don't happen to have a submersible, which I wish I did, but I don't have a way to get down to the bottom of the sea. So the only way to explore then for me, I think, is to write. And so I think writing is a form of exploration in the sense, you know, so Shackleton said, I'm going to get a boat and a crew and we're going to go check out Antarctica. And for me, it's I'm going to get my notebook and my word processor, and I'm going to explore people that way. So I think if I walk into a room, and this is very much the way I get this from my father, walk into a room and there's like three guys standing up and one guy standing on his head, I'm going to go to the guy standing on his head and just sit near him. When I lived in Chicago, it was, you'd go and you'd get on the L, and you always knew, like, because sometimes the train would pull up and there'd be one car with like nobody in it. And at first you're like, this is great. How did I luck out? This whole car's me. Well, you go in there and then there's somebody at the back of the car who's talking to themselves or something like that. And nobody else is getting on that car because they're kind of weirded out. That was the car for me. I would want to get on there as close to that guy as possible and just find out about this guy. Even if I didn't have to interact with him, or even if he didn't allow me to interact with him, just being in his presence was kind of magical. One of the things I tell my creative writing students is, you know, you have to be careful about this, but as a writer, you have to eavesdrop. You have to be able to get near enough to conversations that people are having and spy on them without sort of tipping your hand. And not that you're going to transcribe that, but that's rich with ideas, and that's rich with sort of human interaction. And I always tell my students, if you can get close to a couple who's breaking up or a couple who's falling in love, whether they're on the phone or if they're doing it in person, if you can sort of creep on them and get that, that's golden, and that's very beneficial to your writing. Now, you have to be super careful about it, and you might walk away with a few black eyes at first. But once you get good at it, your writing will really take off. So I guess that's a warning. If you see me in a coffee shop, I'm probably spying on you.
So your new chapbook, are there examples of that in there?
Yeah, I think so. Let me see.
What is a chapbook, incidentally?
Chapbook is sort of, the way I think of a chapbook is sort of like in music, you have a full album and an EP. A chapbook is kind of like an EP. So it's a collection, but maybe not a full collection. This one, you know, they're kind of linked by this theme of urban life. And so I think chapbooks are, and they can be fiction, like this is mostly fiction, but traditionally they were poetry chapbooks, so poems mm-hmm. around a certain subject. But they've branched out into, you know, fiction or hybrid chapbooks or even sort of graphic novel chapbooks. So they're generally linked around a theme and they're shorter than like a full-length collection. That's the best way I understand. Somebody might call in.
It helps. This is,
let me see. Let's see if we can find a good. Okay, here's one. This is actually sort of a Chicago story, but it's called A Cop and a Kid. This is a very short story. I'm sitting at the diner grill, eating a bacon egg sandwich. In comes this cop. He's a big fella who doesn't so much open the door as he does yank it out of his way with a flourish, sort of the way he might yank a bum off a park bench. This cop is dragging a skinny kid by the shirt collar, and I mean this kid is skinny, legs like noodles and ripped jeans, a faded Cubs shirt that looks like he dug it out of the barrel at St. Vincent de Paul. Plus the kid's face is all sucked in around his cheekbones and jawbone, and his top teeth stick out so far it's like they're planted in his bottom lip. Did this kid rob the till yesterday or what? Is this some kind of crazy justice? The cop growls at the kid, sit down, and stabs a finger at the stool next to his own. I freeze watching them, bacon egg sandwich in my hand, halfway up to my mouth. Rich, the fry cook, asks the cop what he'll have, and the cop chooses pancakes. Rich eyeballs the kid, but neither of them say squat, and I suspect that, like me, Rich is wondering what this is all about. Just what in the hell gives? Then the cop says to the kid, in a voice that'd scare the fur off a grizzly bear, now tell the man what you're having. The kid mumbles, a glass of orange juice. And the cop damn near explodes. Orange juice? The kid, I'm not lying, actually ducks. So the cop makes the order himself. 5 pieces of French toast, bacon and sausage, hash browns, 2 fried eggs, a cup of coffee, that glass of orange juice, and a big glass of milk to boot. I'll be damned if the kid doesn't wolf down every crumb. When they finish, and it doesn't take long, the cop lays a little stack of bills on the counter and shoves the kid back outside. They stand face to face right there on the diner grill's welcome mat. The cop barks at the kid nods along, and eventually they walk off in opposite directions. I go back to my sandwich chewing and watching Rich cook. Rich is an ace, cracking the eggs, flipping the bacon, buttering the bread. He's got everything sizzling all at once, with a constant smell of breakfast like smoke off the altar at Holy Name, rising to the ceiling and spreading out all over all the us diners, over Rich too, and even over the junkie in the back with his head on the table who's asleep now and snoring and has been since I came in. So that's called A Cop and a Kid. And it's that's sort of the spy style. The diner grill is a real place in Chicago that I used to eat at, and this is not a real story, but that's the kind of place where cops and criminals could sit down at the bar and leave each other alone and eat their sandwiches and go back to business on the street, chasing each other and running from each other. But it was sort of like a place of sort of a sanctuary in a sense, in the middle of the city. Where this nasty fry cook would cook.
So this is a composite portrait?
I would say so, yeah. It's
not the junkie wasn't necessarily there at the same time. The cop and the kid didn't necessarily come in.
That's right.
But you've seen all those things happen.
Absolutely, absolutely. And even in this particular place, this diner, this, you know, one of these sort of 24/7 Nighthawks type diner. Which is interesting because that painting hangs in Chicago and it's very descriptive of the city and its diner culture, I think. If there is such a thing as a diner culture.
Oh, I think there definitely is,
yeah.
Especially in the city. I don't know if that's still true, but it was certainly true in New York when I lived there in the 70s. You know.
Oh, I would guess that
very
was
very specific culture.
Yes, yeah. That's beautiful.
One of the things that makes your work interesting to me, and it may be that this assumption isn't accurate, but the impression I have is that you are quite comfortable in two very different worlds.
Yeah, I think so. I feel comfortable that way. I'm not sure the inhabitants of those worlds feel comfortable with me there. But I feel comfortable. I'd sort of describe it maybe in a way that I like a very good craft beer every now and then, and I also like rot gut and the cheap stuff, and I like to drink them both.
Is that a result of having done the kind of work you do?
Possibly. I mean, I think, you know, working with men and women in homelessness does provide a certain perspective on the part of the city, but it's not even necessarily city life. I mean, poverty in general does provide a certain perspective, and it gives you end up, I end up understanding, or have understood over time in that kind of work, that there's such a vibrancy and sort of a life when you're with men and women who are in homelessness or in poverty. Now it's the tragedy is much closer to the surface. Desperation is much more apparent than it might be in some other circle, but. So that stuff, you have to be careful about that because that really does impact your spirit. I mean, it really can drag you down. But there is also just a life there and a sort of a special hum of vibrancy that I haven't found in any other circle or any other place. And I mentioned it before, but it's also rubbing off of my own father, who was that way. And, you know, that's something I've inherited for sure from him, is this idea that everybody is interesting. No matter what you look like or what your story is or what your background is, everybody is very, very interesting. And that's something that I wouldn't say he necessarily taught me with words, but that's just how he's always been. So I've picked that up and then tend to gravitate towards the person who appears to have the richest story in the room.
So you thought there was something to be learned from everybody?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And he even still to this day, he's retired, and some of the things he does are, you know, he volunteers, to go into prisons and, speak to the prisoners and stuff. It's like, Dad, you're talking to like murderers. Like, these guys are murderers. And he'll come out and say, he has a story to tell. There's something about this man that, yes, he did kill some people, but there's something to him that is worth examining. And so that's something that's a part of it for me as well, for sure. And I hope that passes on to my own kids, or they might just think, Dad, you're crazy.
I have a friend who was homeless for a long time. He now lives, in my mind, he might as well be homeless. He lives in what do you call those places? It's like an extremely low rent motel.
Like an SRO type?
Yeah. You pay by the week kind of place.
Yeah.
And he complains about how noisy it is and all the rest of it. I'm like, what do you expect?
They're very noisy. Not a lot of peace and quiet there.
And so what is his response to that situation? You know, it really wouldn't be that bad to be back on the street again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you find a lot of people who are, quote, homeless are homeless by choice?
Not a lot. I think in sitting down with somebody who is homeless, or maybe homeless for a long time, so what HUD would call people who are chronically homeless, typically there's even a reason for that. And I think nobody starts out, I would guess, wanting to be homeless. But at a certain point, if you're chronically homeless, you learn how to do it. And you learn where the different food kitchens are in the city, whatever city it is. And you learn safe places to sleep and when the cops do their sweeps and these kind of different things. We all behave that way. People who are rich have their lifestyles that they do and they're comfortable with. And it would be difficult for a person who is rich to go to middle class in the same way that it would be difficult for a chronically homeless person to become housed. Not because the situation isn't better, because to be housed is better than to be homeless, but because that change is such a shock to what you already know and a shock to a lifestyle in some cases. And so it's tough to fault people who are having a difficult time making that lifestyle change, because we all have a difficult time. If we're used to the way we do something, even something as simple as like brushing, like every now and then I'll try to brush my teeth in a sort of a different pattern. It feels alien, feels weird, and I can't do it. And it's, I think to extrapolate that out to somebody who's been in long-term homelessness, like maybe your friend, and I don't know him, but perhaps he could say, well, at least on the streets, I knew how to do things. Here in this SRO motel, where there is a roof over my head, I'm not quite as comfortable with how to do stuff. So it might be better back out there, where I could control the noise in a sense, and then I could move more easily away from it, or something like that.
Do you find any difference between men and women when they're homeless?
I forget the exact stat, but something like 98-99% of women on the streets have been sexually assaulted. So, and a good percentage of men on the streets have also been sexually assaulted, but it's nearly every single woman in homelessness has been assaulted at some point. And that probably is the case if those women are long-term homeless or more shorter-term homeless. I mean, I don't think it takes long for that to occur if you're a woman who's on the streets. So in that sense, I guess one of my observations, maybe somewhat related, is that there you might find more single men homeless, so men just sort of by themselves, and it seems like there, when you find women who are homeless, it might be maybe more with a group of people. Now, that, I'm generalizing a bit, but I would guess it has to do with notions of safety and numbers. But I mean, when a former job, I worked at a family shelter, and there were more women heads of family with their kids who were homeless, without a father or a husband or a boyfriend or whatever. So there was a real strength in that, because these women would say, "I can't be on this. I got to get off the streets. It's not okay for my kids to be there." And again, I'm overgeneralizing, because every now and then we would have a single dad come through and it would say something very similar. But it was more likely in a case like that, that the dad wouldn't be there or would be willing to go. Whereas the mother was not willing ever to go. So I saw a difference there. And again, that's generalizing to a degree, but that was my observation at the time.
Are you still doing that kind of work?
I am, yeah. So my day job is with the Chattanooga Housing Authority. I'm working at College Hill Courts as a case manager. And yeah, so the people that I work with now are usually housed, but usually low income, or maybe have just come from a situation of homelessness. So it's sort of the next step up from working with people who are directly homeless. But I mean, we still do. I mean, people will wander in and say, "Hey, I need a place to go. I don't know where I'm supposed to go." So we'll try.
So we talked about you occupying two different worlds, and now I'm thinking about it. Actually, it's more accurate to say that you occupy three different worlds. You have your family.
Oh yes.
You have the work you do, yes. But you also have the other work you do as a teacher.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
do your two professional worlds ever blur?
I think they dovetail very nicely. And even the third world with my family, because I think for me, the work that I do, and you know, working with homeless men and women and people who are sort of near homelessness, fills me up with a desire to tell stories and actual stories. And that stuff usually never comes out in my own work verbatim, but it sort of percolates in the creative side of my brain, and then it may show back up in a few months in a form that's a little bit unrecognizable, but there's a real source to it. So it makes for a nice writing life to work with people, and then to be able to say, "Hey, I really think that's important," and then to go to students and say, "Here's why this idea of writing and exploring humanity through writing is important." So that works well with the teaching side of things. And then, like as a husband and father, those are things I want to be able to give to my family, values I want to give to my family.
This is Scenic Roots Talking Writing. Our guest is Paul Likert. He has a Facebook page, as well as an active, in the best sense, Twitter account. Closing the program, Paul will read another of his poems from his just-published collection of poems and short stories titled Metropolia.
This is sort of a prose poem called Dancer. She danced in the alley in a blue feather boa, far from the music that pumped through the main drags like floodwater. She danced with wide eyes and puddles of blood, half congealed from a knife fight over a bar tab an hour ago. She bent and tipped and spun and swung her hips to the music in her mind. Her knees popped when she stooped. It was madness, a mad sight, the solitary alley woman in a revelry all her own. It was holiness. She was Davidic, ultra pure even, Saint Marie of the streets, free from sin. Ave Maria. Amen.
This is listener-supported public radio in Chattanooga.